thank everybody for coming out tonight. My name is Brian Shapiro. I'm chair of the Ulster County Government Operations and Environmental Services Committee. I would like to welcome everybody here. This is a forum on the issue of hydrofracking and how it may affect us here in Ulster County. I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. Please look around, see how many people are here. This is a very important community issue. I'm very impressed that people have taken the time, especially on a beautiful day, to come out to talk about an issue that could potentially affect our area, an issue that is a hot topic nationally and regionally as well. This is something, an issue, fracking that could affect us in Ulster County. We have a beautiful area. It's a jewel. We need to do everything we can to protect this area and to respect this area. We need to be vigilant about preserving our resources. Tonight's forum is not just about listening and gathering information. We have two well-educated speakers, esteemed speakers, who are here to join us this evening. This is also an opportunity to create dialogue and to share thoughts. We're going to have an opportunity after a presentation from our speakers for people to ask questions, to opine, and to make observations on this issue, again, as a matter of building community and having a dialogue on fracking. What I would ask is, when it's time, after our presentations, we do have a microphone over here. People can line up and ask questions at that time. As I said, this is a participatory event, and there will also be an opportunity. We have a number of legislators who have joined us this evening as well. I look forward for their observations and input. What I would ask is for individuals to please, when you're speaking, limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will be timing everyone, and please don't take offense if I say time is up. There are probably a lot of people who want to share, and my interest is only in that we have everybody has an opportunity to share their thoughts, and that's very important to me. I would remind everyone, we are a small community. Please be respectful of each other if there's a difference of opinions. Please be respectful of our speakers if there's a difference of opinions. We're very fortunate to have them join us, and I'm sure that won't be an issue. Again, thank you everyone for coming out tonight. I'm sure this will be a very informative evening, not only on our behalf, meaning the presenters, the committee, but we're also very interested in what the public has to say as well. If I may, I'd like to introduce our two speakers. We will start with Ron Bishop, going in alphabetical order. Dr. Ronald Bishop has a bachelor's in chemistry from Youngstown State University and a PhD in biochemistry from the West Virginia University School of Medicine. In 17 years of full-time research, his projects focus on cancer biochemistry and biosafety. He currently teaches chemistry and biochemistry at SUNY Oneonta, and he is a nationally certified chemical hygiene officer, which is a hazardous materials specialist. Ron has extensive construction background and more than 2 years of experience as an investigative journalist. We are also delighted to have Scott Klein, who holds a bachelor's in geological science from Penn State, and both a master's and PhD in petroleum engineering from the University of Oklahoma. As a good reminder, please turn your cell phones off. I will do the same as well. Dr. Klein began his career in 1976 as a geophysicist for Gulf Oil Corporation, now Chevron, and later worked as a geologist, petroleum engineer, and senior manager for several other oil and gas companies based in Houston and Oklahoma City. He's published on a wide range of oil and gas topics. He recently served as a well construction operations subject matter expert for the US EPA technical sessions on hydraulic fracturing in Arlington, Virginia, and at Quebec's Office of Public Hearings on the Environment in regard to formulating oil and gas regulation in the province of Quebec. I just also want to mention, we do have agendas at the front door on that chair if anybody is interested. With that said, we will begin the evening. There will be 20 to 25 minute presentations from each speaker, then an opportunity for dialogue between the speakers and myself as moderator. We will then be joined by a number of elected officials who would like to weigh in on this issue, and then I'm very eager to get to public comment and public questions. And with that said, I introduce Dr. Ronald Bishop. Thank you.
Good evening. Can everybody hear me? Well-educated on the subject of natural gas extraction or hydraulic fracturing. Well-educated on the subject.
Can you be a little louder?
How many of you consider yourselves well-educated on the subject of hydraulic fracturing or natural gas extraction? How many of you may have heard me talk before? Good, not many. Well, don't let me wake you up. What I am going to try to do is go rather rapidly through what I consider a bit of a nuts and bolts talk and bring up some issues along the way. And in some cases, bring up issues that you may, you know, have thought you needed to worry about and maybe you don't. So let's just dive in. First of all, why here? This region was the deepest part of an inland sea. And all oil and gas reserves actually form in these black shales, part of the deep sea, in the abysses of the trenches of the oceans. We had a big one, not in just one geological period, but in at least two of them. And it extends largely up into, as you can see, a large part of the southern tier of New York State. And because of this, you know, there's a lot of oil and especially gas in these source rocks. I mentioned source rocks to bring this up here. When you get what we call conventional deposits, of which there aren't really that much left anymore, you're usually looking at oil and gas that has managed to break free from the shale, which was its source rock, and get, you know, migrate upward as a, you know, result of being squeezed by the rocks overhead until it hits some capping structure. Quite often, that's another shale. And if you drill into a conventional formation like that, it's a little bit like sticking a sippy straw into a juice box that you're squeezing. It, you know, comes right up at you. Well, there aren't too many of those sorts of conventional deposits left anymore. And what energy companies are having to do to get major new sources of these fossil fuels is to go to the source rock, which is the shale. The good news is there's lots of gas and oil there. Bad news, they don't give it up very easily. Okay, and a lot of people have, if you've seen any talks on the subject, have probably seen this slide. It's been everywhere. And I want to use this to indicate the difference, essentially, between a vertical well and a horizontal well. Both of these wells, as you can see, are mocked up as being actually hydraulically fractured. The one on your right-hand side, the vertical well, doesn't actually secure access to a lot of gas in the shale because it's just one little stick coming through whatever is the thickness of that shale layer, the organic rich layer. So for real efficiency, they need to drill horizontally, keep the well bore within the shale, and have lots of access to it with just a single well bore. And part of the reason they need to do this is because the resources needed to develop a shale gas well are just more than you need to develop a conventional well. You don't need to crack rocks in a conventional well, and you don't need to crack them very hard. With a shale well, especially a really deep one, you really have to put on quite a lot of hydraulic fracturing pressure in order to crack the rocks down there. That's a lot of effort. Now, it also uses a lot of resources. In the case of the vertical well, you know, you might be able to develop one of those with between 80 and 120,000 gallons of water if you're using a water-based hydraulic fracturing mixture. In the case of a horizontal well, you'll be using a lot more water. 2 to 8 million gallons is a range that's given. An average Chesapeake was running for a while, was, I think, 5.5 million gallons. Now, a lot of people seem to have an issue with the amount of water that's withdrawn, but one of the ways that New York is actually exquisitely blessed is with lots and lots of water. And so that actually is not quite as much the concern here as it could have been, as it has been in western states. and continues to be in some of those western states. Now, transporting all those liquids and fluids into the well site, that can be a little bit more of an issue. Now, one of the things that we notice around here, and another thing that sets us apart from some of the western states, is that almost anywhere you want to drill a really deep hole around here, you're going to pass through someone's drinking water aquifer somewhere. And nobody wants to mess that up, including the driller, I have to tell you. So what they try to do is to work with the surface, work with a series of steel casings connected to each other and to the ground, you know, around them with concrete. Now what we see here in this mock-up that I unabashedly stole from our former DEC Commissioner Pete Grannis is at the top here you have what's called a conductor casing or chute. That'll be for anywhere from 15 to 100 or so feet, you know, in depth to keep the surface, you know, junk from falling down into your operations inside that for boring through. The next steel segment is called the surface casing. That's what is designed to protect your drinking water aquifer. New York regulations require that the surface casing goes a minimum of 75 feet deeper than the deepest usable groundwater that's in that area. And I know drillers that have begun in our area actually push that a little bit further, and they tend to go to 95 or 100 feet. This next segment of casing that's shown here I won't talk too much about because very few of those are ever actually installed. That's called an intermediate casing, and it's often used where they're expecting pockets of gas from some of the conventional types of resources, you know, types of rocks that are between, you know, that are, you know, on the way down to the shale that's actually the target zone. Or if there are other reasons of a sensitive environmental site and things like that, they are pretty rarely installed. And then there's the production casing that runs full length. Now this particular sketch only shows a vertical well, but in a horizontal well, the production casing also runs full length. There's no open bore drilling in New York. And the casing runs full length, and so does the concrete in New York. That's not always true in Pennsylvania. A mock-up of Pennsylvania shown in this slide here, where you see, you don't see the conductor casing, although Brian Swistock, the guy I got this slide from, said that they are often used in Pennsylvania. You have a surface casing and a production casing. And the concrete, the bottom for sure, and the top for sure, but the middle parts they might seal with a pack or slurry that's sort of like a chlorified drilling mud. That might be one of the reasons that there are more issues, more problems in Pennsylvania. There are troubles occurring at a higher rate than we've actually seen nationally. And I bring this up to mention the point that, you know, you expect of almost any industry that's moving forward with a new innovation or a new technology, that as the industry and the technology mature, you should get better safety results going as time goes forward, and people learn better how to keep the lid on things. Pennsylvania has been kind of an anomaly this way. We haven't seen a drop in the rates of accidents, accidental spills. We haven't seen a drop in the rate of well casing failures. And a lot of people around are really scratching their heads because even in Pennsylvania, DEP, you know, inspectors are starting to attach conditions to well permits that they will concrete to full depth, and they will begin to, you know, put in some erosion and sedimentation controls. So only time will tell, because this larger scale version of drilling with a horizontal component hasn't only been going on in Pennsylvania since about 2003 and going in earnest since about 2005. And that's not a lot of time for us to find out what they're going to be like when they grow up. And we don't have a whole lot of experience with the horizontal drilling here in New York. And some of the other things that I'm going to be talking about, for example, the risk assessment for New York that I prepared, is not much based on a lot of horizontal drilling in our state because there just isn't any of that to work with. What I have done in terms of that risk assessment was take a look at, well, what's gone on up until now? Because that, in terms of risk assessment, you know, language is usually the best guide to what can we expect in the future, at least, you know, looking at an upper limit of how the damage could go. Now, it's typical of, especially modern practice in the shale gas industry, to not just work with a single horizontal well off of a single well pad, but to actually put a number of horizontal wells off a single well pad. This limits the impact on the surface. This limits the footprint. There's one access road in and one pipeline going out if those wells are successful. And this is a good way to actually try to minimize, you know, or mitigate damage, to the environment just from the, industrial operations there. Now, if you happen to live next to a well pad that's going to be having a lot of wells installed on it, you'll have a longer construction phase just because they're putting in a lot of wells and they'll probably stay there until they're built out. Now, New York limits the time that operators can stay on one well pad in the intensive phase of construction to 3 years. It's not known whether, by the time we get there, they'll actually need 3 years, because certain companies, especially lately, have been coming forward with new technologies for faster drilling that are cutting a little bit down on the time it takes to develop a well bore. Now, I'm a chemist, and so we have to talk a little bit about the chemistry. So I want to talk first about what's already in the rocks that we're visiting when we go down deep. And of course, there's organic carbon, either gas or oil. Around here, mostly gas. Actually, around here, we don't know as much as we should because there aren't a lot of test wells in Ulster County. At least not that were reported on. There have been wildcatting operations, all across the state from the 1860s to the 1960s before the state started keeping records. But unless you're willing to go after ad valorem taxes, which will get within a square mile of where that old well might have been, you may have a hard time finding them all. But anyway, there's organic carbon in these shales especially. There are heavy and otherwise toxic metals that can be found there. Somebody brought up to me last night that he doesn't consider barium a heavy metal. Well, that's all right. It's still going to be a bit of a toxicity problem if it's found in soluble forms. But there are some heavy metals that can be extracted from the shales. And there's plenty of brine, lots of salt. Now, some of you may have heard that the salt concentrations of these brines can go from about one, equal to about sea salinity or ocean salinity to about five times that. In New York State, we'll probably never see anything like five times the salinity, because those are from the really, really deep wells, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 feet. And we're not exploring shales that deep in New York State that I know of. But you can see brine levels that go as high as about twice the salinity of ocean water. And the reasoning, of course, is very simple. The water that's down there has been, there in and around those shales for a really, really long time. And it's leached from the rock everything that it can take over, say, 300 some million years. Now, many of you have also heard that there are radioactive elements that are found in these shales. And I have to tell you that if you want to stay up at night, worrying about something, this would not be it. I live close to an outcropping of some of the Marcellus shale. It's just about 15 miles north of my house. And I've had opportunity to take umpteen pieces of shale out of that outcropping and other sources and measure them with a Geiger counter. Now, those of you who are scientists know that a Geiger counter is probably not the best way to measure something like radium or uranium, because they're primarily alpha emitters. But if there was radioactivity there, I would see it above background. And the pieces of rock I've gotten my hands on are cold. They're not radioactive. Does this mean that there isn't any radioactivity in the shale and it's all been a hoax? No. There are hot spots in the shale. Of all places to have a hot spot, Marcellus, New York, is one of them. And people who live there, where their basement's sitting in the shale, have radon problems. So what I'm saying is that you don't want to assume it's hot and worry, and you don't want to assume it's cold. This is something that needs to be monitored, just to put that out there for you. I think most people are in a mode of doing some monitoring when they're drilling into the Marcellus or the Utica layers, just because there are these issues that we don't know. And with rock formations like this that can run hot and cold, you want to be on the safe side and just measure before you assume it. Hydrogen sulfide can also be a problem. The bacteria that form hydrogen sulfide. Does everybody know what hydrogen sulfide is? It's called sewer gas. Does that help them? People who have sulfur water, do you call it sulfur water down here in Ulster County? Okay, it's pretty common because areas that have hydrocarbon reserves under them tend to have a lot of these sulfate-reducing bacteria all through, a large number of their rock formations. And if your water well happens to be sunk into a rock formation that has hydrogen sulfide, then it'll smell a little bit like sewer gas. And if it smells pretty bad, it's probably safe. Because when hydrogen sulfide starts to get up into the higher concentrations where it's dangerous, it begins to smell sweet. If it gets in even higher concentrations, it paralyzes your olfactory nerve and you can't smell it at all. But then again, if you stay there in that, you won't be smelling anything ever again. So New York State has a drinking water standard for hydrogen sulfide that's 10 parts per billion. But we can detect, most of us can detect hydrogen sulfide in water down to between 0.5 and 1 part per billion. So you can have pretty skanky water that's actually technically safe to drink, at least for the short term. But if my brother-in-law has a farm in Otsego County, and he happens to have some hydrogen sulfide in his well, and they'll do the laundry with it and things like that, but they cook and stuff with bottled water, just what you do. So hydrogen sulfide can be an issue. I'll bring up one of the issues that can come up. It's not known to be common, but it is something that has come up before. The point I want to make at this point in time, though, is that without any chemical additives, produced fluids or flowback fluids from wells tend to include some hazardous materials. And you want to be aware of this because we don't really need chemical additives in the natural gas extraction process to give us pause. We actually want to be careful with all the flowback, whether we've seen a large use of additives or not. There's loads of salt, some heavy and otherwise toxic metals. There can be some gases, including radon and hydrogen sulfide. The gases are a special concern because they move more than liquids. Liquids don't move much at all. But the gases, if they're there, first of all, can travel to very, very tiny fissures in the rock down to a thousandth of an inch. And second of all, they're just more mobile. They'll go and make themselves, a bit of a pest, even when liquids will stay where you put them. Now, to try to drive home what I'm talking about in a matter of economy of scale, some flowback fluids from Marcellus shale wells up in my neck of the woods have actually been measured. And I got this slide from my colleague at SUNY Oneonta who did the measurements. And what we're looking at on this slide, on this left-hand side, is the scale here, every line that you see is tenfold higher in concentration than the one below. So we cover a lot of concentration ground with a slide like this. This particular line reflects 1 part per trillion. 3 lines up reflects 1 part per million. Okay, 1 part per thousand, and so on. On the high side of these things that you're going to find in flowback fluids, they're all on the left-hand side. We have total dissolved solids, that's what TDS is, chlorides, sodium, calcium, magnesium, the things you're used to hearing of are in hard water. Also, sort of on the high side, you can get appreciable levels of strontium and barium, quite often high iron, so high that it tends to make a problem with plating out. Additives are over here. And although you see this line covering quite a bit of territory, for most well projects that don't have a lot of special needs, the median for the use of additives is on the bottom line, parts per trillion. This is individual atoms, additives, not all of them together. And then, of course, you've got also sort of on the low side, manganese. Often it's on the low side, not always. Lead, arsenic, and so on, oil and grease. So this kind of hopefully gives you some idea. Now, why do we need additives for this process? Well, shale rocks tend to be fairly well enriched in clay structures, and clay swells when you hit it with simple water. And you don't want a well to swell shut after you've drilled it. That has got to be annoying. So so they'll put in additives to control the clay and stabilize it. You also don't want the bacteria or the archaea that live down there to grow, because in addition to quite often carrying out a lot of oxidation and reduction chemical processes, they're famous for making biofilms. So your sulfate-reducing bacteria, your iron, your manganese and magnesium, zinc-reducing bacteria, all these bacteria and archaea are just famous for plugging pores with their biofilms. You can't let them grow down there if you want to have a successful well. So you've got to kill them with biocides. Corrosion is also a real threat. Think about it. The bottom of a 3,000 or 4,000 foot deep well is going to be usually just a little bit north of 140 degrees Fahrenheit. That's pretty warm water, and there's a lot of brine down there. And we're going down with some metal parts. So corrosion can happen rather rapidly, and they've got to use corrosion inhibitors. So that's why those sorts of additives are used. Proppants like sand and sometimes the ceramic beads, sometimes coated sand with typically in the whole polymerized acrylonitrile. These sorts of things are also used in order to stimulate and get the well working. And there can be other chemical conditioners depending on what the operators find on the site. Every well is different, and no two are going to be the same. Now, another thing I'd like to try to help explode is approved for use in New York are more than 200 different chemical products that actually are made up of only about 170 different chemicals. It has never happened, and it will never happen, that they all get used in a single well. Typically, you're going to have anything from 5 to 15 different chemical products used, you know, in the production of a well. If it's really complicated, you'll be on the high side. Most of them are not really complicated, and between 5 and 7 or 8 different chemical products are what you would expect to see used. Even so, although some of the products used by the oil and gas industry, or the gas industry lately, are really pretty innocuous, you know, things that we could very well compare to like Mountain Dew or, they use citric acid if there's high iron, and you also find that in Mountain Dew. Those innocuous compounds actually are in the minority, and more than 3/4 of them pose health hazards, especially if you encounter them in a concentrated form. Most people who are neighbors to a gas well won't really encounter these in a concentrated form unless there's a spill on the well pad that gets out of control. But if that sort of thing comes up, you can then be subject to things like respiratory diseases, some endocrine diseases. The problem with endocrine involvement is that endocrine disruptor medicine is a new field of medicine. As a field, it's barely 10 years old. And what we're learning about endocrine disruptors and how they influence gland behavior and different organ systems behavior in people is that they don't follow the rules toxicologists have learned all their lives. The dose doesn't really make the poison with an endocrine disruptor. Some of them are actually more dangerous when they're really, really diluted than when you have a gob of the stuff. And it's turning out that a handful of the chemical products used by the natural gas industry are emerging as endocrine disruptors for various systems. Especially if you happen to have methane mixed with hydrogen sulfide gas, there have been infertility and birth defects, not with people, but with livestock. This is especially problematic if you have what they call sour gas, high levels of hydrogen sulfide coming up with the methane. And of course, for a lot of the people who are working on the sites who are involved with trucking or transporting or handling these liquids, if things go wrong, they can be subject, you know, to concentrated solutions which can then, you know, set off, you know, kidney, heart, liver, and sometimes brain damage. And a handful of the known flowback constituents, not just additives but other things that are already in the shale, are also known to be especially suspect of causing or helping to cause various kinds of cancers. Different ones, of course, specific for different cancers. I call this panel My Chemicals of Special Concern because, first of all, I can probably handle 200 different chemicals and keep them all in my head. In fact, I do a lot better than that, but then I teach chemistry. I call these special concern chemicals because even when they're ridiculously diluted, if you're exposed to them in any meaningful way or for any length of time, you'll have a health impact. Barium, Now, most barium that's used in or encountered in the natural gas industry is in an insoluble form. It's in a salt that doesn't dissolve in water and doesn't migrate through your body very well. But if it gets converted to a chloride or a bromide, it's bad news. And there have been some instances of barium toxicity in showing up in people neighboring to gas wells where things went wrong. Lead and arsenic, I don't have to say a whole lot about that. There is a small, usually a very tiny amount of benzene. Sometimes benzene is in products that are used as additives, and even when they're used at a small level, it can be of some concern. Most shales, and quite often the sandstones over the shales, have some small amounts of benzene and other aromatic hydrocarbons like aniline and quinoline in them. And none of them are really your friends. 2-butoxyethanol is a very commonly used product, especially for top hole drilling. It's a foaming agent. It's also a co-solvent used in a lot of the different solvents, a lot of the different products to keep everything in an emulsion or in the solution the way it needs to be. It's also in wide use all over the place as a degreaser, as a component of some window wash solutions, at least that it was until lately. Windex has stopped using it. And they stopped using it when it was shown in the last few years to be an endocrine disruptor with impacts on the adrenal and thyroid glands. So bromide has become a problem that many of us weren't expecting. And again, bromide and bromate is emerging just lately as an endocrine disruptor with impacts, particularly on the thyroid gland again. Chromium, if you encounter it in these shales, is something you want to be aware of. It's not often at really high levels, but there are, especially in the Utica shales, significant levels of strontium chromate, and in that form, chromium is fairly carcinogenic. I already spoke a little bit about hydrogen sulfide, and the bottom one on the list is one that I have not heard much talk about, and I'm not sure how much it's going to be a player in New York, because no one in New York has bothered to test for it here. But in wells across southern Pennsylvania and into West Virginia, and this is data taken from our own DEC's generic environmental impact statement draft, it was found in every well that was tested in at pretty high levels. It's not known to be an additive, and it's also not known to be naturally occurring in the shales. It's everybody's best guess, including my own, is that it's a product of interaction between additives that are used in stimulating fluids and naturally occurring components in the shale. I'm hoping to carry out some research over the summer to work out the chemical mechanism that's most likely for it to be formed underground. What's significant about 4-NQO is that it's one of the most potent carcinogens known. It's used by research scientists to induce tumors in laboratory animals because it never fails. In humans, it's especially hazardous as an oral carcinogen, although it has induced tumors in a large number of other sites. So, erosion and fragmentation. Just want to bring these up as issues that you all can read, and I'm going to move quickly here. New York has erosion and sedimentation controls for gas well operations as well as for any other industrial operation. And to the extent that they are, our regulators are able to keep a lid on things, we should not see a whole lot of excess erosion sedimentation that are not controlled on the well pad. Having said that, I should mention that our DEC actually is rather strained as far as human and financial resources. We have 16 field agents across the state right now responsible for 13,300 or so currently active oil and gas wells. That's about 800 wells for every inspector, and to be frank, they're not getting out to them all. And sediment erosion and sediment controls remain issues for the life of the well pad, along with the access road. Habitat fragmentation from access roads can be a really big deal. Now the legal spacing unit in New York at the moment is a 40-acre spacing for wells. We're anticipating that will change radically, and they will not be able to space them this close. Because if you do 40-acre spacing of wells, you can do what happened here to the Allegheny National Forest in northwestern Pennsylvania. And so we're all very much hoping, and frankly, realistically anticipating that our our legislators and regulators will not permit this spacing unit to continue to be the law of the land in New York going forward. It's not, they don't need to do that anymore. Trucks would be an issue. You've heard about it, and it's probably true. Unless they find ways to move water onto sites with piping or with fresh water impoundments and things, there will be as many as 1,000 truck trips for every horizontal well that's drilled. There are companies moving forward aggressively with means to reduce the number of truck trips, both by recycling and reusing fluids from one well to the next, particularly on the same pad, and also piping in water from freshwater impoundments. But not all companies operate at the Cadillac level, and that's something that we just have to be aware of. There are the best, and then there are the rest, and there are a lot of the rest in our state. Murphy's Law is going to happen on any construction project, and I don't care where you go to get a construction project done. I'm an industrial commercial electrician, and I've seen horror stories I'm not going to bore you with right now. Now, these sorts of things radically going wrong with the gas industry happen at a pretty low rate. Industry representatives will usually tell you they have a good safety record, and they do. The rate of contaminating groundwater over the short term from gas wells nationwide is about one groundwater contamination incident for every 50 wells developed. That's over the short term. That's a 98% safety record. Well, okay, I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of different opinions out there. Over the long term, it's a tougher call, because not as many studies have been done over the long term. Things about abandoned wells and so forth. I'm not going to talk too much about some of this stuff. I'm running out of time. Over the longer term, we have other fish to fry. And one of them is that we have a large number of abandoned wells scattered across New York State. Approximately half of their locations are known. According to the 2009 annual report from the DEC's Division of Mineral Resources, they actually discovered more abandoned wells in 2009 than they were able to plug. So I was saying that we have a backlog of 280 years, but if they keep having years like 2009, our backlog could be essentially eternal if we don't get more resources put into the plugging of the abandoned wells. Probably not so many of those abandoned wells are around here. Most of them are probably where the most intensive drilling has taken place. But again, the state really didn't keep these records and didn't begin to keep these records until 1966. And so from our first well in New York in 1821 until 1966, we don't really have good records on where the abandoned wells are. Now, laws were in place since 1879 that these things had to be plugged. But the evidence speaks for itself. We have a lot that aren't plugged. And these are portals. Some of them are shallow and some are deep. They actually run the whole gamut. Some of them run into very, very shallow conventional resources. Some run pretty deep into areas below the shales that we're exploding now. There's no broad brush you can paint these abandoned wells with, except that they're an unsolved problem for our DEC and for our state. The EPA estimated in 1987 and then fresh report in 1992, that one out of every six abandoned and orphaned wells across the U.S. is leaking now. If that's true, we already have an ongoing contamination problem going. We just don't know the scope of it because not many studies have been done on human health impacts. Ongoing work on impairment of waterways aren't really set up to test the periphery of these abandoned wells. There's essentially no monitoring that's done of abandoned wells, even well-plugged ones, once the bond is returned to the driller. So I'm not going to tell you that it's a horrible thing. Some of it has got to be not good, but I can't tell you how horrible, because records aren't really being kept in an ongoing basis on wells that have been well-controlled and well-plugged. Some industry analysts have suggested that well casings break down, they don't care what they were plugged with. And in their particular research articles published in the year 2000, they estimated that in a 100-year time frame, cracking and shrinking of even the concrete plugs was considered inevitable, which would make them prone to leaking if they repressurize from below. That'll do it for me. I don't want to take up all the time, and I want to leave some room for some active discussion. Hopefully you have exploded some myths. I may have raised some other issues you may not have known about. I try to tell it as I see it, though. This is my contact information. This is my personal, not my work email. I can be reached at the Chemistry and Biochemistry Department about one day a week through the summer. Good luck with that.
Sir, a question from the floor. No matter what happens, rich people in New York City will continue to be rich and eat a lot of food while we stay normal, right?
Thank you. There will be an opportunity for public comment. I appreciate you.
Okay, I'm glad rich people are rich in New York City.
Thank you, sir. Yep, a round of applause for Dr. Dr. Anthony is going to queue up in this presentation. Round of applause for Anthony. Dr. Klein.
Thank you, Ron. That was a great talk, and really, I learned a few things, as I always do at these meetings, and actually the very few things I found that I might disagree with you about, we'll discuss later. I'm going to take a little bit different approach tonight. I am going to talk about the technology that was my specialty. I was a petroleum engineer and geologist, and well construction, cementing, fracture stimulation. Touch on all those. Ron actually did a pretty good overview of that. But I like to start my talks by really talking about the big picture, though, just to kind of set the stage before we talk about the technology and where the risks might be and where they might not be. I think it's useful to talk about what is the shale gas. Well, and so I like to start out by really just talking about how much is there. Why is it such a big deal? You know, what's happened? As many of you, I'm sure, recall, just 2007, we were in an energy shortage here. Oil was $150 a barrel. We thought we were running out of natural gas. We were looking at alternatives, and then all of a sudden, almost overnight, we have tremendous, vast, new resource that's available that we didn't know about. That's an important thing to think about, not only in terms of whether you want to use it to develop it, but in terms of a vast, low-priced resource as domestic is going to be a very difficult thing.
If we can please allow the speaker to continue. We will have an opportunity.
I'm not advocating natural gas, by the way. I'm just trying to lay out why it is such a big deal and why it's so important. It's not just the drilling's coming to New York or there. This is a national energy policy issue that you have to make choices about. And I'm not saying that natural gas is the way to go, but I want you to know how big a deal it is. How much money is involved, and how much politics is going to be involved. So, and I think that's, you know, I'm trying to give you that information. So then I'm going to talk about what's the potential impact of natural gas in New York, and what is shale gas, and where is it in New York? Is it likely to be in this area? Where, if not, where is it going to be? And then we'll talk about how it's developed, and I'd like to go from the pre-drill through the reclamation. May not get into the controversies and misconceptions of the discussion, but we'll see how it goes. As I was talking about just a few years ago, we didn't know we had the availability of this resource. Now it looks like probably just the Marcellus alone will easily become the second largest gas deposit in the world. If you combine it with Utica, it may end up being the largest one. So now we've gone from, you can see in 2001, an estimate of 1.3 TCF of gas to now potential Marcellus alone, 850 trillion cubic feet of gas, which just from that deposit alone is a 40-year supply of gas at our current rate. Horizontal drilling coupled with fracture stimulation, that's what's made this possible. It's not one or the other. You have to have horizontal drilling, and you have to couple it with fracture stimulation. One or the other is not going to make this an economic quantity. As I said, it's going to probably be at least the number two field in the world. It possibly could be number one. I can tell you from what's going on down in Pennsylvania right now, as we've drilled down to the Marcellus, we have found probably four or five other shales that have good potential too. Probably not what would have been developed on its own, but because the infrastructure will be in place, adding more and more to the resource. It's huge. I keep hearing people talk about, well, New York is a small player in this. We aren't the biggest, Pennsylvania will be, but if you take that 850 trillion cubic foot figure, looks like we're going to have probably about 20% of that in New York, which is still a lot of gas, 160 trillion cubic feet of gas. The consequence of the vast resource is twofold. Obviously, we have a source for combining with the other shales that we've found. We probably have at least a century, maybe far more than that is at current consumption rates. The consequence of that also is that natural gas prices have been depressed. And now natural gas is probably on par with coal, being the lowest price energy source by far. This kind of shows you the disconnect between oil prices and gas prices that have happened all of a sudden. In the past, natural gas pretty much tracked the price of oil. It always sold at a little bit of a discount, but as oil went up, natural gas went up. Now you see recently a total disconnect where we have $120 oil. Natural gas on an oil price equivalent is selling for around $20 a barrel. So it's a much cheaper fuel with vast abundance. We're going to need 20% more by 2035, 20% more energy consumption in this country. So I think this is a good diagram to look at to begin this discussion, or to begin thinking about where we're at here. Right now, fossil fuels make up 85% of our energy source in this country. That's divided up between 37% petroleum, 23% gas, 22% coal, renewables, 7%, most of which is hydroelectric, and nuclear power, 8.5%. That's our supply sources. Again, 85% of that's coming from fossil fuels right now. The thing about the natural gas now is that it could, if we desire it, completely replace coal and electrical generation, and to a large extent replace petroleum and ground transportation, and could be used in electricity generation for even electrical vehicles. The main constraint in using natural gas in the past really has been perceived supply shortage. That's really been erased now. So if we as a country want to substitute for coal and petroleum, it is a possibility now. I do want to talk about, this is my last slide before we get into the technical parts, the impact on the New York economy. I hear many speakers say that this is only going to benefit the few, and those being the landowners. And to some extent, that is true, that the landowners will benefit disproportionately. Whether or not you believe that's fair or not is really not the question, but there will be jobs, there will be income tax, sales tax, etc. I'm not going to get into how to quantify those or how many jobs, or whether they're permanent, whether it's boom and bust. But I do want to talk about those, the ad valorem tax. This is where I think people miss the point that it does benefit the local communities, because New York, unlike Pennsylvania, has an ad valorem tax on oil and gas production, and it is substantial. I did this calculation recently for a talk in Otsego, just using their tax base up in that county, and a single Marcellus well drilled in its first year would generate local ad valorem taxes of $275,000. Over the life of the well, a typical Marcellus well, depending on your tax rate, will be about $1 million of local tax revenue going to schools, counties, towns, in combination. And if you multiply that by several hundred wells, you can see the tax implication is actually quite staggering. And there are many communities in the southern tier that could actually almost eliminate the entire property tax with the drilling of a few hundred wells. And by the way, those taxes are paid by the operator. They're not paid by the individual landowner. So just to recap before we get into the technical set part of this session is that I don't think you can ignore the fact that the economic impact is large, and that's going to be a driving force in these decisions also, not only environmental. These are complex issues involving economics, environment, and landowner rights. It's a complex situation, but there are big dollars involved. These are large amounts of money, large, vast gas deposits, and you need to understand how large it is and how many dollars are involved. It's
you haven't said anything about the environment, actually.
Let them talk.
Thank you. Please continue.
So, just to summarize what I was talking about, the mineral owners under a 1,280-acre pad, which is what these are going to be developed on, not 40 acres, so we'll get into that in a minute, with 8 laterals. They would share, the landowners would share in a minimum of $20 million of royalty, probably $5 million of lease bonus, and each one of those wells generating $1 million of local property taxes. So, just set the backdrop, let's talk about the shale gas development. What is it? Ron talked about the shale gas is both, contrary to the conventional aquifers that we went into, it is both the source and the reservoir. It's a triple mechanism system. The gas has been generated millions of years ago. The actual generation of that natural gas has actually created the fractures in the rock. That was the first natural hydraulic fracturing that was done several hundred million years ago. So gas is not only trapped in the fractures, but in the matrix of the rock, and it's absorbed onto the actual rock itself. Why do we combine horizontal wells and fracture stimulation? Because it's a sealed fracture system. It will not produce economic quantities of gas without help. Shale has extremely large gas in place, but low permeability. In other words, it can't be delivered to the wellbore in paying quantities by just drilling it. And actually, when I talk about those huge numbers of gas, we're only expecting to extract probably 20% of the gas that is actually in place, even with horizontal drilling and fracture stimulation. So you can imagine how much is actually in the rock that we're not even going to be able to get to. The goal is to expose a large surface area and create a high-speed path to the wellbore. It's all about getting reserves, getting them fast, makes the economics better. I want to show this diagram to really show you, help you understand what we're really trying to accomplish here. If we drill, it's all about surface area. The more surface area that you can expose the wellbore to in the rock, the more gas you can extract, the faster you can get it. If you drill a vertical well, in this, you'll see you have 160 square feet of contact between the wellbore and the rock. If I drill a horizontal well, even 2,000 feet, and we're actually drilling up to 9,000 feet, almost 2 miles in some cases horizontally. But in this example, you can get the surface contact of 20 vertical wells. That's still not enough. And add that onto that, the fracture stimulation, we can get up to the equivalent of 957 vertical wells in this simple example. So it's the horizontal well, fracture stimulation combination opens up more surface area to the rock to drain that reservoir. In reality, in the slick water fracture stimulations that we're doing, we can get effective surface areas of 24 to 60 million square feet. And that's a lot of surface area in the subsurface. And we're going to do that basically by injecting, on average, 5 million gallons of fluid and 5 million pounds of proppant. Just give you an idea what that looks like, just so you have a kind of an idea what 5 million gallons of fluid and 5 million pounds of proppant looks like. If we're going to, if you were to take for instance, a football field, 5 million pounds of proppant is the equivalent of about a 1 foot covering of sand over a football field. And 5 million gallons of water would be about 12 feet of water fluid covering a football field. That's about what we're trying to put down each well. And we're trying to distribute that over a volume that is basically made up of 80 acres by 100 feet thick. So there's a lot of water and sand. It's a small part of that actual volumetric slab that we're trying to expose, but it is still significant. The natural fracturing of the Marcellus, this is a surface expression of what it looks like. It wouldn't actually be like that totally in the subsurface because of the pressure of the overburden keeps those fractures disconnected and closed, but generally this is the idea. Is the fractures are oriented perpendicular to each other in a northwest southeast and a northeast southwest pattern, as you can see depicted here, labeled a And the idea of what we want to do is we want to drill this horizontal well. Basically, these wells are going to go north to the northwest, and we're going to drill another one down to the southwest, or to the southeast. And when we fracture stimulate it, our fractures are going to be generated perpendicular to the well bore so that we can intersect the natural fractures and help open up the original fractures that are in the in the Marcellus.
Vertical means up and down, and horizontal is right and left, right?
Yeah.
This is going to take one person to steal from the people next to them. Please.
That is pause.
Okay, so where is the Marcellus? We talked a little bit about what it is, how we're going to get it, but where is the Marcellus in Utica, New York? This is basically a map showing you, I think Ron used the same slide, I think everybody does, basically showing you the aerial extent of the Marcellus. That's just showing where it's present, but where is it likely to be developed? It's not going to be developed in all those areas. And the reason for that is because the Marcellus, as Ron mentioned, is not uniform. It varies from place to place, and we need certain ingredients to make it economic to extract. We need a high organic content. We usually like call it, we want 2% total organic content. We need thermal maturity. It has to be cooked just right. It can't be, it has to be subjected to the right thermal history. If it's too high, it's cooked too much the rock. If it's too low, it hasn't generated the hydrocarbons. It has to have thickness. The thicker the rock, the more gas is in place. It has to have depth. We want it to be deep because we want pore pressure. The more pressure in that rock, the more reserves you can encounter. We want a brittle rock. The Marcellus actually does not have much clay content. It is a very brittle rock. It fractures nicely for us. We want an existing fracture network, and we want overlying and underlying strata to confine our fracture stimulation. This is a good summary map. The references are on here for anybody to look up. There are a lot more maps in these references to look at that give you a good idea where the Marcellus is, where the Utica is. A lot of this work is done by the New York State Museum geology staff. Done very good work. And this is kind of the summary map of the best guess of where the formation is going to be prospective. As I tell people, until we start drilling, we really don't know for sure. But this is our best guess. And you can see the area in yellow is the Marcellus fairway. And the colored area is what we think might be the Utica fairway. The Marcellus, as you saw before, is present overall, this area out to the west, as well as Utica. But because of those combinations of ingredients, these are the areas that we anticipate to be most prospective. The other thing to notice here is that we want, again, I mentioned depth. So depth has been superimposed up here. That's why this line is cut here, because this is the Marcellus that's geochemically prospective and also is deep enough to give us that pressure.
Is that line of depth or line of depth up there on the...
I haven't gotten to the line of death yet, but it is death. This is something recent, and the reason I put that on there is this is recent in the literature. Recent drilling has given this line to us. You can see in the past we thought perhaps this area over here was possibly very prospective for Marcellus and Utica. Yeah, it's somewhat more doubtful now because this is the line between production to the west and dry holes that we're finding in the Marcellus to the east, because we're finding that the shale is too thermally mature. We talked about that before. And Terry Engelder, the well-known geologist at Penn State, calls this the line of death. In other words, thermal maturity, it's been cooked too much. We don't expect the Marcellus to be prospective east of that line. We just don't really know where it goes in New York yet. We only know we can place it here based on wells drilled in Pennsylvania. And if you just follow the natural tectonic trend, that's where you would project it. Again, we don't know for sure, but I think the eastern parts, including probably Ulster County, may not be prospective. But again, until we drill, we don't know for sure, but something to keep in mind. I live over here in the Fingers Lakes area, and I typically show this to explain to them that they're not going to have Marcellus. Where I live, the Marcellus is present, but it's only 600 feet deep, and we're not going to be drilling Marcellus at those depths. Why aren't we going to do it? Well, I told you before about the depth, the pore pressure. There's a couple of other very important reasons, one of which is we can't create vertical fractures at depths less than 3,000 feet. Once we get shallow, fractures are generated perpendicular to the direction of least stress. As we get shallower, that becomes the vertical. And so as we get shallower, instead of creating vertical fractures, the fractures rotate and we can only create horizontal fractures along the bedding planes. That doesn't help us from a standpoint of an extraction process. We can't stimulate the formation well enough. We can't get the reserves out. We're not interested in that. So 3,000 feet from just a fracturing standpoint is really our limit. Additionally, New York's proposed regulations don't even allow large volume stimulations shallower than 2,000 feet without a site-specific review. Another reason, it's just not going to be happening. So I think you can be pretty confident that 3,000 feet and probably more like 4,000 is the shallowest. Horizontal drilling doesn't look much different than vertical drilling at the surface. There's no question about that. The pad sizes are almost identical, a little bit larger pad for a vertical well than a horizontal well. The activity level that goes on at that pad is substantially greater, and we're going to drill more than one well from that pad, but the actual surface disturbance is not much different. Ron talked about 40-acre spacing, and that's one of the few areas that I disagreed with him. The spacing for the high-volume Marcellus wells in New York is going to be 640 acres. In reality, in Pennsylvania, we're drilling on 1,280 acres. In other words, it's going to be one pad on every 1,280 acres, not every 40 acres. So that's about 2 miles apart for your pad. So from a surface standpoint, development-wise, New York's going to, I understand from the DEC, they're going to allow us to do the 1280s by putting back-to-back 640 units. But you're going to have one pad of about 4 acres every 2 miles. That's your surface disturbance. It's not like this, which I don't know if it's the same slide again that Rod used, but it's similar. This is what 40-acre spacing looks like out in Wyoming with a lot of vertical wells. But if you look at that landscape and you look at what 1,280-acre units are, you would only have 3 of these pads in this entire landscape. Very widely spaced, very limited surface disturbance from the actual drilling pad. The subsurface is another story. It is intensive drilling in the subsurface. We're going to be drilling these laterals about a mile long, so that from that surface pad location, you can see in this diagram showing 8 wells. That's going to be probably typical. And each one of those horizontal laterals is going to go out about a mile. So that gives you a mile in each direction off a common pad, makes your 1,280 acre units. These are the basic steps in the drilling reclamation and production. The site selection, the well site selection, and in New York that includes water testing. I don't know if I didn't hear Ron talk about that, but we require extensive water testing. Pre-drilling, not just baseline testing in the pre-drill stage, but continually at certain intervals during the development of that pad, going on into at least a year after the pad has been fully developed, so that we can get a baseline and we can see if there are any changes in the nearby water quality of the water wells over time. The next step is the pad present preparation, drilling the well, casing construction, completing the well, producing it, collecting and treating the produced water, and marketing and reclaiming the site. That's the basic cycle. We have regulations in New York at every step. A lot of the regulations that we have proposed, and I think Ron mentioned that also in his talk dealing with casing, would have prevented the methane migration problems that we've had in Pennsylvania. And I think the record speaks already clearly in New York. In 30 years of drilling over 10,000 wells, there's only been one case of methane migration reported. I'm sure we will. And what I want to stress to you is that there is no difference in the vertical well casing design between a horizontal and a vertical well, basically. And so that your methane migration is coming from the shallow surface, the shallow gas zones, not from the production zone. We have stormwater pollution plans required for drill pads in New York. Strict surface casing design and inspections. Casing, as Ron mentioned, has to be cemented to the surface. Not only conductor surface casing, but also the production casing.
All right, well, let's not do it in New York.
The references for all these things are also here if you have any questions about what is required. They're predominantly in Chapter 7 and Appendix 10 of the proposed regulations. The issue of chemical disclosure comes up quite frequently. I will be absolutely shocked if full chemical disclosure isn't mandated in the final regulations. It's just inconceivable. Permits, they have to have. You must have a plan to deal with your produced water before you even get the permit. We can argue about whether that's an adequate plan or whether New York might have adequate requirements of how you deal with that water. We don't really know what those are going to be yet. But you have to meet the specifications of whatever regulations are going to be before you get the permit.
Can you give some examples of how you regulate what you're
doing? There'll be questions in just a moment.
There are, contrary to popular opinion, there are no pits allowed in New York for produced water on site. They have to be directed to steel tanks. Just the drilling pad construction itself is meant to be self-contained with liner. Liner is under the entire drill site. Secondary containment facilities for any of the fueling or chemical storage portions of the site, and the site is a gravel berm around it. All topsoil that has been stripped to build the site has to also be stockpiled and saved for reclamation. It's not taken away. Ron went through the casing design. I think we'll probably end up talking about this quite a bit in the discussion, but just to reiterate, we have four casing and cement sheets inside of each other. Blowout preventer installed, must be tested. After surface casing set, centralizers have to be run to keep that pipe centered in the hole during cementing. Casing and cement pressure tested and logged at each casing stage, and no annular pressure is allowed to be built up in New York. Two of those things were missing in some of the things that went on in Pennsylvania. One was lack of cement to the surface and allowing annular pressure buildup to the extent that it broke down some of the surface casing cement. Water usage is large but manageable. Ron already touched on that. I'm not going to dwell on that too much other than to say that we are blessed in this area with more than enough water. I don't think anybody's too concerned about that anymore. Okay, well then let's go through the slide. Okay. All right, well, we'll talk about it in the commentary. But let me just throw this out to you, that actually the amount of water generated from the combustion of the natural gas generated from a Marcellus well is 8 times the amount that is actually used in the stimulation. I think Ron covered the what's in the frac fluid well enough. I highly recommend writing this down, because this is a new program by the Groundwater Protection Council under its 8-Well Compact Commission. You can go, click on any well in Pennsylvania, and it will give you all the chemicals that are actually being used. So that if you've got if you're a landowner next to it, you can find out exactly what chemicals are being used. The one thing, I know I am running out of time, but this is an important thing to understand, that of the water we're injecting in the well, only about 10 to 20% of it's coming back. So a lot of people are concerned about what happens to that water in the subsurface. Why does so little water return, and does it matter? Think back to what I was talking about with that large surface area that we're opening up. When we open up 24 to 60 million square feet of surface area, we're injecting that water is imbibed into the fracture space and only is penetrating about 4 to 6 inches. Once that's imbibed, because the capillary pressures are so great in these tight shales, that water cannot escape. It is trapped in there for geologic time. Even if it could move, it's going to move toward the lowest pressure, which is going to be the wellbore. It's not going anywhere else. In addition to that, we have the thousands of feet of impermeable layers above that we've all heard so much about. How do we know for sure how far those fractures? I think we already had a question about that. We know from microseismic testing. Microseismic testing is basically listening in an offset well as the fractures are propagated. We can map those very accurately, very precisely. This is a diagram showing, on the top of it shows the depth of the deepest groundwater in the area. On the bottom shows you how high the fractures have actually been generated in the wells, and you can see the several thousand feet of separation between the groundwater source and the highest known fractures. In addition, remember that most of those fractures are not being propped open anyway. After we release the fracture pressure, which only lasts a matter of hours, the natural overburdened forces want to close those fractures, so we're only going to end up propping open the fractures that are a few hundred feet tall. And since I'm running out of time, I'm just going to get to my take on things. As I mentioned, the resource is vast. Its long-term price pressure will be immense. I don't foresee natural gas prices rising in a generation, unless we end up using it as a substitute for coal and other things. Surface needed for drilling is minimal. I will stress that 1,280 acres, it's not a big surface impact. Subsurface migration of hydrofracking fluids is implausible. Microannular gas migration does happen, but when it does, it's typically insignificant and fixable if necessary. Methane migration because of shallow gas zones is going to occur sometimes. There are times when we are going to encounter that. Produced water will be recycled typically, or I'm expecting in New York it will be required to be treated to drinking water standards if it is not recycled. I could be wrong, but that's where I think the DEC and Department of Health are headed. The traffic influx in workers is definitely disruptive. There is a lot of machinery, a lot of equipment. When it comes to town, it can be overwhelming. That's probably the largest drawback to it in my mind. And as a community, is that compatible with existing land uses? That's a question that people have to to weigh for themselves. It may not be in some areas. It may be that you can work around it. I know in the Finger Lakes they've talked about possibly working with the companies to work around the tourist season. There are ways to collaborate and work this out. Because the stakes for the landowners who have the rights to minerals are great also and should not be minimized. And so I have to cut it off there. Thank you very much.
What I would like at this time, we have a little over a half an hour. I definitely want to have public participation. I would ask if there are any legislators who wanted to join me for, I'm going to give my legislator colleagues 2 minutes to speak, which is 1 minute less than the public. So I would ask that individuals please be concise with their comments. Legislator Don Gregorius wishes to speak, and I am joined by Don in District 2.
This is a subject that is really important. It's a subject that so far in the presentation has talked about the economics that are involved and scientific data. And for me, I'm concerned when I walked in here and it still hasn't solved some of the issues that I have. And I think probably the best people to solve what I have is the people that are in the audience, and hopefully they can hear from you. The county has passed a ban on hydrofracking for county-owned property. All of the legislators participated in that, and it shows our commitment and our concern to the issue. And I don't think we're anywhere near understanding the environmental implications and our health implications. In doing research, I thought it was important to try and get information together. 2 minutes, you can't do it. So I found something that I would like to call everyone's attention to. You probably know about it already, but if you go into the New York Times, February 26, 2011, there's an article on regulation lacks in gas wells, tainted water hits rivers. And what I'd like to do, this says it better than I can, and somebody else has put their touch on it so that we can all understand. So I'd just like to read a bit of it to you so to maybe spark some interest. The relatively new drilling method known as high-volume horizontal hydraulic fracturing or hydrofracking carries significant environmental risks. It involves injecting huge amounts of water mixed with sand and chemicals at high pressures to break up rock formations and release gas. With hydrofracking, we can produce over 1 million gallons of wastewater that often is laced with highly corrosive salts, carcinogens like benzene, radioactive elements like radium, all of which can occur naturally in thousands of feet underground. Other carcinogenic materials can be added to the wastewater by chemicals used in hydrofracking. While the existence of toxic waste has been reported, thousands of internal documents obtained by the New York Times from the Environmental Protection Agency state that regulators and drillers show that the dangers to the environment and health are greater than previously understood. I think I'm running out of time for my other colleagues. The article goes on and on about concern. And I hope it gets addressed, because so far we've heard about the economics, we've heard about the state. I think we need to hear about our environment and our health. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Susan, if you'd like to come up, Susan Zimmett from New Pulse, who's been, I have to give Susan credit, she's been very active on this issue. Thank you.
Since there's very little time, I'll just get to a couple of things. First and foremost, I don't think there's a person in this room who does not know that water is the liquid gold of the future. So how we can take our precious water that's owned by everybody in this room and let a bunch of companies make a profit off of our water that they don't pay for is absolutely horrendous. So don't talk to me about the taxes. Talk to me about the money you're going to pay for the water you're using of ours. To pay attention to what's going on up in Albany, and that's what you have to pay attention. Ulster County did pass a resolution banning hydrofracking on county property, and we'll start getting out to towns, to towns, to towns. But understand that that was a very big move. It was totally unanimous, Republicans and Democrats together saying this is an intrusive industry and we don't want it here. And so you should thank every one of your legislators when you go home. your eye on. There's a hazardous waste bill up in Albany that we have to get past this session that will be basically, it's a very, very important bill. Please go look at it. Call your, I don't have the number right with me right now. I can get it to you later. Please call your state senators. I suspect it'll pass the assembly. Call your state senators, tell them to get their name on the bill and pass it. It's imperative. There's also a moratorium. The moratorium we worked on last year that miraculously got passed, but Patterson vetoed, but it's okay. Good things came out of it. There's a new one that just got introduced by Silver Sweeney. There's yet to be a Republican sponsor in the Senate. Call your senators, tell them we want that moratorium extended. The DEC needs another year to study this before they do anything. This is very intense. And keep your eyes out, because what's gonna happen, what we believe up in Albany, they'll exempt the watershed, but then they'll frack the hell out of upstate New York. So keep your eyes on it, call Cuomo's office, keep the pressure on, and next week go to cleanwaternotdirtydrilling.org, next Tuesday or Wednesday, because we have a really wonderful surprise waiting for you. Thanks.
Thank you, Susan. What I would ask for individuals who would like to make statements or ask questions from our panel, we have a microphone. What I would ask for people who wish to make a comment, we have Anthony who's over at the microphone right now. Please line up, and there is room to go around the back.
Joe, hello.
Thank you for your input, Anthony.